You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Today is the first installment of our summer series, the series of genres. And I'm starting off the series with three particular movies by one filmmaker that are a trilogy, but also the genre of whodunits. And who better to invite for this Blanc episode, Blancology, or whatever you want to call it, than my Christy co-hosts, Sam. Good afternoon, Sam.
Hi there, Julie.
And Alan. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
So today we'll be just be doing the three movies in chronological order and in the context of detective fiction, specifically golden age of detective fiction. So that would be Knives Out, Glass Onion, and Wake Up Dead Man. And listeners, be warned, we are going to spoil the lot. If you haven't seen either of these three, do yourself a favor and shut off the podcast and come back to us later after you've seen them. I'm usually quite spoiler-proof, but it would be such a pity to spoil these, as it's half of the joy to try to figure out who did the murder. All right, let me start just as a conversation starter. Which of the three is your favorite? Sam, perhaps we start with you.
Now, having seen them again, I think before I would have said Wake Up Dead Man would have been my favorite. Now, seeing all of the three again, I must say the first one sticks out as the best to me. It just has the perfect mix of setting, the cast is great, the introduction, obviously, of Benoit Blanc. And the case and the way it's built up, the way we see things that might be true, might not be true, different versions. It's very layered. And I did enjoy a lot the thematic thread going through it of the Ana de Armas character versus the elites, which I think is a theme that runs through all three films very much. You know, I picked up on that watching all three. But the first one, it really is kind of the go-to. I could watch that one over and over again, I think.
Alan, which is yours?
I mean, this feels like picking a favorite child. I mean, I do enjoy all three of them. The one thing I will say, which is I do really like the second, and I'm not sure whether I'd say it's my favorite, but I do think when Knives Out was a hit, you almost would have understood if they'd just decided that the sequel would be another sort of posh mystery set in a posh house with a drawing room at the end where all the suspects are gathered to reveal the murderer. That would have been a very easy way of saying the format is we're going to stick in exactly this world, the very safe world of sort of ripping off that sort of Agatha Christie style format. And the fact that it did something very different, I really enjoy it. And I think that sort of set the franchise up a bit more for running and running in a way that it couldn't have done. So I sort of admire the bravery of the second for doing something different like that.
Yeah, with me, it's a close call between Knives Out, so the first one. But I also really, really loved Wake Up Dead Man, the last one. So I'm going to pick Wake Up Dead Man, just to be contrary. I really love that one because I sort of like the idea of how it plays with the rules of what we understand to be detective fiction. And because of the reading list, and we're going to come to that a little bit later, the movie features a list of a couple of very famous detective novels from the Golden Age, but also before. And these set up the expectations of what is to be the plot of the movie, if not its solution in the end. But we're going to get to that when we get to the movie. So we start with Knives Out. First one, chronologically, 2019, is a closed house mystery of the classical vein. It's a very sort of threatening seeming house, really huge, and it is owned by an old man who writes detective fiction. And he ends up murdered. It is ruled initially a suicide, but then questions arise. Does anyone actually slit one's own throat? And so on. That is how he was found. And we get to meet the whole cast of characters. This is an ensemble piece. So we get a lot of good stuff. Great, great characters. And they're all horrid, except for the nurse, Ana de Armas, who is also our protagonist and also our very sort of dubious Watson. So guys, Knives Out, your favorite part, your favorite characters, your favorite plot twist. And Alan, I will have a specific question for you later. I wrote that down. So let's start with you.
Well, I would say I've mentioned the cast before, and I think having Christopher Plummer as the patriarch, and then Jamie Lee Curtis and Toni Collette and Don Johnson and, you know, all, Chris Evans and so on. I think the cast of the family members, as despicable as they are, but they're really perfectly cast here. You know, you can sometimes find Jamie Lee Curtis a little bit too over the top. Don Johnson, not the greatest actor of them all, but in a way here they are so perfectly juxtaposed as these greedy, untrustworthy family members who are set up to be lying from the very beginning as soon as they're questioned by police and then by Benoit Blanc once he appears from the shadows. Just a bunch of liars and a bunch of versions that of things that could have happened. And I think I did really admire that. I'm always a fan of, you know, star casts. I'm sure we'll talk about that with another genre as well. But to see these small, sometimes bit pieces played by all well-known and prolific actors and actresses, I really enjoyed that here. I think it sets up the mystery really well. And then once Benoit Blanc is in the picture and he starts picking them apart, I think it helps to have this cast of standout characters down to, you know, the very, very old grandmother or great-grandmother, depending on perspective. And obviously the unraveling of the mystery and the different versions. So that's why I admire Knives Out always.
I mean, I think the thing I really remember from when I first watched it is exactly like Sam said, you have this cast of liars, grotesques, or idiots, and they're all perfectly pitched. Like the moment they appear on screen, like they are what you think they are. They're very sort of clearly drawn characters. And so when I was watching the original, you don't know that Benoit Blanc isn't an idiot. He comes across as an idiot, and I was watching it and thinking, like, maybe he's not going to solve this at all because he is an idiot. And there was this sort of lovely sort of feeling because, you know, the format hadn't been established. You didn't know for sure that, you know, he is the central detective that's going to be in other films. He could just be another of the idiots in this sort of parade of people lying to each other. And so as you're sort of watching it and you don't know where it's going, and he keeps messing up. It's sort of a standard thing that he seems to make mistakes. He does stuff. He realizes stuff's going wrong far too late. And so you have all this suggestion that he might be an idiot. That sort of wrong foots you for the bit where suddenly he comes out and goes, right, I've worked it out. This is the answer. And I really enjoyed that not knowing, which you'll never get again. Like in all the future ones, he is the famous detective Benoit Blanc, and he has this, you know, we know he's clever. But just for this first one, as you're watching it, that feeling that he might not be the detective that solves it, or it might not be a drama that ends with a solution that is actually who murdered it. We might find out as an audience, but the story might end with the murderer getting away with it. So all of this was there watching the first one, which was very exciting, which weirdly I think made the end very traditional conclusion all the more satisfying because it suddenly came in and it's, oh, I know where we are now. This is that kind of drama. So that I think was a highlight of the first one.
I have a question for you. In the last Christie episode that we did, we talked about adaptations of Christie more generally, and we talked about The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which we are also going to spoil, audience, the unreliable narrator in which the person from whose perspective the novel is written is the killer. And we were wondering how you would adapt that to screen because it relies so much on you reading the book. But I think this is how you might do it, because in Knives Out, you get these flashbacks of what actually happened. You don't immediately know whether they're reliable or not, but it's pretty clear pretty early on that these are actual flashbacks to the occurrences, which gives it a Columbo-y feel, right? So we, the viewer, we know more than the detectives do because we have this insight into the actual happenings of the night in which the murder occurred. So Michael Shannon's fallout with his father, the comically horrifying, constant harping on Ana de Armas' origins and keep getting it wrong, Paraguay, Uruguay, really funny, really, really penetrating and really, really awful. But I was thinking, Alan, were to adapt Ackroyd, is this how you would do it?
I mean, I think there's something that it does really well is playing that humour of what they're saying happened and the flashback of what really happened, that has so much comedic value that you're seeing it. I'd be interested if you tried to do it with Aykroyd, where you would put the point where what the Aykroyd character would be saying and what the flashback of him basically doing the murder, where you'd put that in the adaptation. Would you have it early on? Would you still save it for near the end? But I think, yeah, there would be a way of that difference that we get to learn as the audience when the detective hasn't. That would definitely be a way of doing it. I mean, I'm still wedded that you just go the whole Columbo and just show him doing the death at the beginning, and then, you know, Poirot turns up and works it out. But yeah, no, I can see that that's definitely a really smart way of doing it. Is, I mean, like I said, they mind it for more comedy here, but it's an interesting way of playing with the idea that a character says something and we see the flashback, and rather than the flashback reflecting what they say, being what really happened. And that, I think, is a sort of smart way it handles it.
In Aykroyd's case, hiding the dictaphone, yeah.
It's very well played, I think, also because it's established so early, right? I mean, this whole scene where Benoit Blanc sits in the background playing just one key on the piano to signal something, I guess. I think it's very well done that we get the kind of the grammar, the filmic grammar, early on, so we know how this is going. I think if it had been introduced later or just like in small pieces, it might have been confusing. But I think the film, and I guess also in the writing, it's very well played that they say, okay, this is a very filmic way of doing something similar to what you said. You normally read and then understand as a reader, how do you do that in pictures? And I think it's very cleverly written. I mean, all three are very cleverly written by Rian Johnson. And I really enjoyed the humor, but also the cleverness of it and how much the audience is in on these techniques. Sometimes, not always.
And it also gives you the rules. These are the rules. He's not going to lie to you. The detective may or may not solve the puzzle in the end. But what you see is, quote unquote, the truth. And this is important because I sort of maintain that this is a film in very much in the tradition of the very classic detective novels of the 1920s. And not so much the sort of very Victorian, bloody, psychological, semi-supernatural sort of kind of thing. It's like Grand Guignol, and this is what he signals. He says, okay, this is what happens, audience. You've seen it now exactly as it happens. Draw your own conclusions. And as Alan says, the detective may or may not actually solve the crime. As, for instance, in a Victorian example, the Moonstone, the detective, there is a detective, but he does not end up solving the mystery. In this case, the detective does, and he should have done much earlier, because I think the sort of the clue of the broken trellis that keeps being retrieved for him by the dog, the baseball that he keeps putting in his pocket, that are all very sort of important clues. And then at the end, he is just not as stupid as he looks, is an interesting way of going about it. And that sort of ties it up as a sort of Agatha Christie-ish type of story, right?
But I think you could have had, it feels like the sort of story that could have ended with the murderer getting away with it. You know, you don't know watching it whether it might be, because it's so darkly comic that you don't know how committed it is to being that dark, that it could end with, you know, it could end with Benoit Blanc being arrested for it, and we as the audience know he's innocent, but the murderer's got away with it, and that would have been the final dark comic twist. And it's a very good, it's a good film for that. Watching the first one the first time, because you just don't know exactly what this story is, I think there's a lot of fun sort of enjoying it on that sense, because I did see this in the cinema when it came out. So it was very much, I think, I saw a very good review, went to see it, but I did go to see it not knowing anything about it. And yeah, it's a really good film for that.
I think also the references to other whodunits are really interesting in it, obviously, you know, apart from Christie. And I thought, you know, we discussed Evil Under the Sun and Death on the Nile, that also has these sometimes false flashbacks and sometimes real flashbacks. Obviously, there's references to Poirot and how he solves it. I guess the French-sounding name, I'm not sure exactly where the inspiration comes from. But I think also, I thought a lot about Sleuth, you know, Laurence Olivier in The House especially. So Christopher Plummer gave me a lot of Sleuth vibes as well. And obviously also Murder by Death, and they mentioned Clue, the game, and even the film, I think. So obviously the setting and the house and the twistiness of the house and the tricks that Plummer can pull up his sleeves and the advice he gives. There were a lot of like these 70s cozy crime, including the Columbo episodes that I think are similar in design. Stein. The one with Ruth Gordon came to mind, for instance, or the Crime Writer, the very first one directed by Spielberg. So there's a lot of things that this triggered. And I thought for a film buff or film buffs like us, it's also this like almost like Benoit Blanc, you know, hitting the keys every once in a while. You're like, oh, this is a bit like that. And it could go in more the comedic direction. Or is it really just a direct reference? Or is it just playing on it? It has a very good balance of these fan references without then just becoming a collection of different scenes. It still is properly written and properly thought through.
Yeah, let's pick it apart a little bit just for clarity. We get the quote-unquote flashback in which the nurse gives the patriarch the wrong medicine, we think. And he tells her to escape, make sure she's not seen, and then proceeds to commit suicide, let's say. However, we're not done yet, because as in Columbo, there has to be a twist, because otherwise we would know who did it. And in the end, it turns out to be a setup, very crazy, crazy, crazy setup that hinges on who of the family would have known that this would happen before it happened, if it was an accident, if it went the way we think it went. So there is still a mystery there. There's still a twist there. But we keep wondering for the first half of the film where this is going, because we, as the audience, know what happened. And we just see Benoit Blanc shadow boxing and running after things that may or may not be there. But he was paid by someone, and he doesn't know who paid him to look into something that was ruled initially a suicide. And that is the mystery that he is going after in his own bloodhound fashion, which is both Columbo-y, but also sort of harkens back to, I don't know, sort of Niall Marsh, Marjorie Allingham type cozy crime in which you think you know what happened, but there is more to it, plot-wise. And Sleuth and Murder by Death and all that sort of thing makes you think that it may be a spoof or a pastiche, but it's really very much its own detective mystery, rather like sort of the new cozy crime, Richard Osman and the Thursday Murder Club, and that sort of more modern cozy crime fiction that is very sort of in fashion now.
And I do like that it's very true to cozy crime in the sense that it's not 100% cozy. I think something that occasionally gets missed when people do cozy crime is you do have to have the moments of nastiness. You've got an old man slitting his own throat. You know, this is the stuff of like verging, it's on the edge of horror. And I always like when cozy crime has just something really nasty in it, because it almost fits the genre better than just everyone sitting in a cafe drinking tea and talking about crime. It has to have that little bit of nastiness to really be proper cozy crime for me.
And I think what sets it apart is the Ana de Armas storyline. I think that's what I noticed about all Knives Out films. There's this underdog character, very central character to the film. And the way Benoit Blanc relates to them, and especially here to Ana de Armas, there's something very touching and very empowering about it as well. And I think each of the Knives Out films has this character that is somehow set apart by a group of the elite in one way or another. And I think in this one, it's most successful, I think, this setting a part of her, obviously from the family as the nurse, but also the good relationship she has with the patriarch, with Christopher Plummer, and then the development of the relationship with the detective and how she herself is very, you know, first very insecure in this, but then grows into stature and in her role throughout the film. I think that to me is like, you know, with all the references to other whodunits, that's what sets Knives Out apart. We really do care about her. And I think also about the characters in the other Knives Out films, more or less, because they have this anti-elitist and very empowering role in these films. And I think that's really what makes it so enjoyable as well, besides all the soothing and the clues.
Yeah, she's staggeringly good in this. She is absolutely... I don't know, it wasn't certainly not her first film role, but it must be the biggest that she'd done up until then. She is staggeringly good in it. And then she made it into James Bond with Daniel Craig in a very different...
Yeah, such a, and it's also such a good scene, you know, if you think of No Time to Die. This is my favorite scene in the film, and they're the same actors, but it just goes to show how good they are. And I thought of Daniel Craig in all the three films. I mean, obviously I've liked him as Bond, but you only realize what a good versatile actor he is seeing him in as Benoit Blanc and going through the different versions of Benoit Blanc in the three films.
Yeah, I loved him pre-Bond. I mean, he's been somebody who was so good before and that made it big. And then there's this perception of the kind of character he plays, and then he sort of flips it entirely and becomes Benoit Blanc, which is a lot of fun.
I mean, I imagine this must have been like a fabulous like palate cleanser after doing, you know, Bond for a couple of years, that you get to be clumsy, you get to be seen as a bit of an idiot, you get to be someone that everyone thinks you're not up to much, you have a silly voice. I think it must have been so much fun to do this post-Bond. It really must have been like an entertaining thing. And I think it says something that like they took Ana de Armas, and her part in the Bond film is very much added for her to some extent. I think it was like a reshoot. It was, we want a bit more action. We'll just take a diversion to Cuba or whatever, and we'll feature her for 5 minutes. And then when he leaves, we don't, you know, it just doesn't really further the plot that much. And it really is sort of like, we want to have a bit more action in this film. And you just imagine Daniel Craig, well, I know who you can cast in this. It will work really well. And so, yeah, this is sort of, it's all parallel to the Bond world that Daniel Craig is starring in. You can see the links, and you can also see how much fun this must be as an anti-Bond, and then how much fun Ana de Armas must have had in Bond, because her character is almost anti what it is in this film. It's just like, right, you can be completely the opposite. You don't have to be what you were earlier. So, yeah, it's a nice seeing them running in parallel like that.
Let's then move on to the Tech Bro installment, which is Glass Onion, which, again, featured an ensemble cast. It features a whodunit in a way, which is about a death, but also about a fraud. And everybody is so flaky in it that it's it's just this side of murder by death, really. At some, you know, instances, I'm like, is this tipping over into complete farce? But it sort of hangs together. It sort of hangs together in a way. And I enjoy the satire of it. I mean, I read a review, I think it was about Knives Out, but it might as well have been this one, that said that social satire is a part of detective fiction, which I thought was a weird observation, because it's not really, at least not in the classical sense. I don't think you could accuse Dame Agatha Christie of being a social satirist in any sense. Maybe Dorothy Sayers in terms of her comments on class society. But I didn't see that observation, but these certainly are social satire. Whatever you think they refer to, they are. And the Tech Bros premise that he's basically a moron who stole someone's idea and then got fabulously rich and then thought he was all that while he was still just basically a little boy playing with toys that are too expensive for him was, I thought, howlingly funny. But it could have been a little bit more, it could have been sharper, better observed, it could have been more penetrating, but it's still howlingly funny. It's, I think it's just great for the fireworks on screen.
Well, I'm very curious, because Alan, you mentioned that that's kind of your favorite, and I have a lot of admiration for it. You know, I think for the setup, the island gave me a lot of Evil Under the Sun every once in a while. It's also this over-the-top quality it has, and the contrast it is with the first Knives Out. I think I agree with that. It's, if you want a palate cleanser after the first Knives Out, then Glass Onion gives you unexpected stuff. And I love the boxes that come in at the beginning and the mystery of this invitation, which turns out just to be a stupid card in an intricate box. So the satire is really great in a way, but I didn't enjoy the execution and I didn't enjoy the cast as much. Maybe that was like on purpose. Everyone's dickish here, probably very much on purpose, but at the same time, they're not quite, I don't want to say the same quality cast as the first one was, but they're almost like so unlikable that it's like too much. And I kept watching this and thought, well, I admire this, but I really don't enjoy watching this. And I had the same feeling the first time around already. So whereas the cozy crime in the first one is very satisfying, this is admirable, but jarring to the point of where I don't want to see this again. It's very odd. Alan, tell me a little bit about your feelings.
Well, I was just thinking whether the unlikable quality hits harder on this one, because they seem, and real seems to be the wrong word, but they seem to relate more to the modern world. So these are characters that exist today that we kind of have to deal with today. We're not safe from people like this if they're idiots. So the fact they're unlikable hits harder than when you've just got a family that are in their own mansion and they're all unlikable, but it's almost like an abstract exercise. It's like the cast of Clue running around the house. They can all be unlikable, but it doesn't matter. Whereas here, their unlikability is always reminding us that these people run the world that we live in. That the fact they're horrible is uncomfortable, I think, a little bit, which I think, again, is sort of like we can do something different with this format, which I think is why I really sort of admire Glass Onion. And the other thing with watching it is that it revealed to me, I think, what I love about this franchise. And that is the extent to which it's always an exercise in misdirection. So the storytelling is, it doesn't lie, it doesn't cheat, but you're watching it, you assume something, and then the story will flip that around and you suddenly realize you're watching something else. And I think one of my favorite moments is when Daniel Craig is talking to the wealthy owner of the island, saying, oh, I got sent the box. And he's like, I didn't send you a box. And up until that point, you just assume that the whole story was he was one of the people invited to the island by this incredibly wealthy person via a box. You suddenly have this, you realize everything you've seen before is not what you initially took it as. And all of these films have so much fun with that. Because at no point can you say, oh, you tricked me. The fact that him getting the box turns out to be one of the characters bringing the ruins of a box to him at his flat. We were shown all enough to have realized that's what happened, but it isn't what happened. And then later in the film, it'll just go, this is actually what you thought happened. It's actually this. And throughout, I think, Glass Onion, but throughout all three films, I think I adore the level of misdirection that isn't a cheat. It's just really nicely done. And yeah, I think it's really well done in Glass Onion. And I think it's my favorite bit of this trilogy.
Also my line into this, but you maybe want to correct me, but the scene with the party where the flaky blonde lady opens the silly box, it gave me sort of flashbacks to the Baz Luhrmann, I think it's The Great Gatsby, the Leo DiCaprio one. And that sort of set me up, and I may be wrong, but that sort of sets me up. This is a world in which people get their toys and they just break them and they just ruin everything that they touch. And that followed through to such a literal extent to the end where they just smash all the glass statues and just burn the Mona Lisa is that, yes, literally, that I saw this as intentional. I haven't read up any interviews on this. So it landed a little bit better with me than it did for you, Sam, because I was like, well, this at least makes sense in a literary way. You have these people who, I forget the literal quote, but who dissect the frogs and break all their toys. And he makes that literal for us in this detective mystery setting in which, we will get to the rules of detective fiction later and how he breaks them. But we get the twin sister. And one of the rules of detective fiction is no doppelgangers, no twins. We have a twin. But it's so well done. It's extraordinarily well done. Who wants to figure out the mystery of her sister's death? But not only that, she wants to clear her sister's name because she was the one who actually had the idea that made the fortune of these really horrible, destructive people. And you're right to say, Alan, they're a little bit too close for comfort. And maybe that's why they're this broad. I think they are meant to be this broad because otherwise it would start to get uncomfortable. I really think that if we had an actual sort of Muskian, Bezosian reference here, it would not have worked.
I think my problem with it is probably also just like I adored the references of the first Knives Out. Here, the references seem to be to films that I also admire, but don't enjoy. I thought of Fight Club, obviously, with, you know, Edward Norton and kind of twistiness of that. I thought also of The Social Network, you know, the whole Zuckerberg setup with a stolen idea at the very beginning. So it's interesting how mood and references play a big role for me, whether I enjoy this, you know, over-the-top execution. Also, the big finale with the smashing of the glass. And I like it on paper. The idea is kind of cool. But then watching it in like this very artificial, you know, CGI fashion and, you know, technically Janelle Monáe walking away and getting her revenge is great. But the film just lathers it on too much. It's and that's why in the end I was like, yeah, I enjoyed watching it for the twistiness, obviously, because I'd only seen it the second time now. And now the big twist in the middle with the sisters was great. But again, it's better on paper than it is executed as a film with this cast that is not quite as poignant as the other two, I find. But it's odd. Yeah, I should admire it more.
Wasn't Monáe just fabulous, though? I mean, she tears up this entire, I think she's fantastic in this. And it's interesting because of the sort of character that she is in real life. She's seen some interviews, very identity-based. She's a bit flaky, non-binary, sort of very interested in your projection of yourself to the outer world. What does that mean? What's your identity then? And she likes to sort of switch that about. And she, of all people, is the straight character in this whole flaky business, which I thought was kind of brilliant. I kind of wanted her to completely go out there. I think she would have been intensely enjoyable doing that. But I think it was a conscious choice to make her as straight as possible.
But it's one of the wonderful twists of misdirection is she sort of turns up and she seems initially you think, oh my God, this is someone who's really tough, no nonsense. And it's only one of the twists you later realize it's not the tough, it's the non-tough sister who's really shy and nervous and is having to pretend to be her. And then you see all the scenes again with the fact that the moment you stop watching the bit you saw first time, the real person came through. Suddenly, the moment she turned a corner, she panicked because she's having to play this, like her sister who was seen as being incredibly tough and strong-willed, and she isn't. And again, that little misdirect, because we're all watching it thinking, oh, this character's like that. And then at a point it goes, no, she wasn't. She's actually someone acting at that and trying to be that. And I think that sort of little twist, those sort of twists in the film is what I really like about it. And I do think, just to go back to the point regarding its relevancy or the element to which it's satire, I have read that Rian Johnson has said, you know, he doesn't write anything before he sits down and says, I'm making another Knives Out film, here's my blank page, I'm going to write. And one of the reasons he says he does that is he wants it to feel relevant to what's happening at the time. So he doesn't want to be writing out of abstract ideas that fit in maybe the cozy crime genre that he can just slightly rehash. It is sort of like, what is happening at the moment? And how can I sort of make that an element of what's happening? So this notion of disruptors, this notion of the incredibly wealthy being also idiots, that obviously 2022 feels very, or still does, but it's very relevant. And that being part of the script is interesting. I will say that I do find it's not a fatal flaw, but I think that the hardest thing I get to grips with in this is I don't buy that these people are connected in the way we're told they are. That they're all from these different worlds and they all hang out together and they were all friends and that's they're all getting back together. And at no point did I think that would be a thing, that these people would hang out in the way they do. That was an obvious contrivance that I think the film has to say, look, you're just going to have to live with this. Just accept it. Because even in the early, you have the sort of flashbacks, the early scenes where they all hung out in the same bar. And I just thought these people wouldn't hang out in the same bar. They just seem too different. They're in two different worlds. You know people like this. People like this don't expand their horizons. They don't have a world like this. They live in their comfort zone. And so I think that contrivance, that it is an ask too far, I think, in terms of the credibility of the plot. Whereas, of course, a whole family living in a big house, you buy that. They're all going to be very different, but they're forced to be together because it's family. But this one, they're all together because they like being together. And it's just like, well, no, they don't. They're completely different. So I think that's the real problem I have with Glass Onion, is the sort of central plot. It's a contrivance too far on one level for me. And stuff like, I mean, you know, there's a napkin that is the evidence for this. It seems incredibly naive. Like, I don't quite understand that everything can rest on a napkin that exists. again, you have to buy into it. You have to accept, okay, if they can produce this napkin, his multi-billion dollar empire is going to collapse. I don't think the world works like that. But once I've made that acceptance of leaping into this world, then I do really enjoy just the sheer level of misdirection in this.
I just want a tangent to just make a little link to the Ustinov Christies that we talked about earlier. I mean, the styling in all of these is very well done, but the styling in this one is impeccable. I love the way that the style sense of these people says so much about them. I mean, the stupid bathing suits, the little sunscreen that the lady politician has on her head. And again, Monet's dresses, her jewelry. Have you noticed the earrings? I mean, it is impeccably done. It speaks, just as the Christie ones do, immediately to the character that is on screen. You don't need any dialogue. You see Norton playing his stupid guitar in his stupid pajama bottoms, and you know immediately what you're dealing with. I think that is smashing about it. I think that is really, really well done. I also trolled the internet for at least a week to find those earrings because I wanted those earrings. That is neither here nor there. And also just in a little bit of a defense of this contrivance that Alan, you just referenced, that is not in the end what the resolution hinges on. So the napkin, the little MacGuffin napkin with the Glass Onion logo at the bottom, that really made me laugh. What it hinges on in the end is the testimony of the people who are there in court, sworn testimony. So how do we convince them that they have to testify that this was not the idea of the Edward Norton character? And rehabilitate the original inventor, so the sister.
So, but maybe put it this way, where the film ends, I still think there's scope for all of them to backtrack. They've all said they're going to turn their back on Edward Norton and there will be like restitution. I don't buy that any of these characters' principal change of view will last. They could very easily, between now and any court case, be turned by a bit of money and say, no, 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 there wasn't a napkin. What napkin? You know, it all feels like the contrivance is there to drive the plot along. But if you really stop and look at it, it doesn't add up to much. And even the resolution is kind of like, I don't see how it's that triumphant. And it's weird because, like I said, I'm sort of defending this one, but it's the one you do have to, with Cozy Crime a lot, you do have to make that acceptance of a contrivance in the story. And this one asks so much, and a lot more, I think, than the other two. And I think at the end, if you sort of stop and think about it, it does sort of slightly start to fall apart. You can do that weird thing of mental gymnastics where you can, okay, I can fill the gap and make it work. But you do have to do that. And I think the sharpest scripts, it's all there. But yeah, I still enjoy this a lot. And weirdly, actually, what I found quite interesting is this seems very the closest. It feels very 70s to me, which I think we have a reference to sort of like the Agatha Christie adaptations from that era as well, because they're enjoying location. They've gone big. And then you've got the celebrity cast. You've got incredible costumes.
Styling is so good.
So this feels a little, you know, this reminds me of Death on the Nile. This is like Ustinov's Death on the Nile in 2022. I think it's got that vibe to it. And I sort of really, really enjoy it for that. That it's like, again, I don't think people go, oh, we're making a franchise that rips off Agatha Christie. I think people are so convinced it's the countryside crime or it's something very gothic or something. And this is like, no, no, it's all out in the sun and bright and lovely and sunny and everyone looks incredible.
Evil under the sun, yeah.
It's a vibe. It's not, I'm not saying it's the same or it's as good, but weirdly, that's what the film reminded me of when I first saw it. The sort of sweeping orchestral shots over the ocean as we get to an island. It's very Death on the Nile.
It should be, but to me it just isn't, you know. It's not my vibe, and I think it's the contrivances and the visuals that I really mind. I think the island crime I love. I adore Evil Under the Sun and great costumes and everything and a good cast. But I don't know what it is. You know, we came close and I do admire listening to all these aspects of what's likable about it. It's just odd that I really don't like it. It's almost like, you know, Rian Johnson doing Star Wars. It should be good. But then in the end, you know, everybody hated him for doing The Last Jedi. There's some decisions that were taken in that film that made it not at all likable. But that's a different story.
Don't go there.
I mean, this is another podcast. I will defend The Last Jedi a lot. I'm a massive fan of that. For me, that's where the franchise ends.
Okay. Well, that's another discussion then.
Yeah, no, that probably is. Like, he does make choices that either land or don't land. That's probably part of it.
It's just possible that it doesn't gel for you, you know. And I mean, I have that with movies that I am supposed to love a lot and that people keep recommending to me, and it just doesn't gel. And I don't know why. I mean, that's completely valid.
Especially with bold choices, you know, we all love bold choices, but they either land or they don't. And here, oddly enough, in comparison, it was more enjoyable to see it again. And I would probably watch it again just to go through, you know, the emotions again of why I don't care about this. But I think it's also just in comparison to Knives Out with what we said about Ana de Armas and the whole elite versus this character story. This should be the same here, but I care less. And it has to do, obviously, with a setup and maybe with this too close for comfort. But I really care less about this, which is then very different for the third one.
Yeah, let's do the segue. Wake up, Dead Man. I want to start this a little bit differently and not go into the plot first. I want to start with a reading list because this was, you have to imagine me literally bouncing up and down when they come up with the reading list because I live for this stuff. I'm an enormous sort of classic detective fiction fan and I love this stuff. So at some point in Wake Up, Dead Man, Benoit Blanc finds what is the reading list of the book club of these people, this parish, this church parish. And let me just, it's very brief, so let me just read it out. It's The Hollow Man by Dixon Carr. It's Whose Body by Dorothy L. Sayers. It's Murders in the Rue Morgue. It's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which we did refer to before by Agatha Christie, and Murder at the Vicarage. And in this one, you would think it's more referential than it is, by the way, that I'm starting this. But this references directly the link between classic detective fiction and this film. And one of the joys for me, but this is personal, right? This will land differently for everybody. One of the joys for me was to figure out what links this reading list and the actual plot of the actual film, which is about a parish priest who gets transferred to a small parish in the middle of nowhere, run by a dictatorial, male chauvinist, power-hungry, horrible pig of a priest who insists on being called Monseigneur and terrorizes everyone and has this really small, ossified group of flaky followers who stick to him because they extract some sort of identity from being a part of this very select and very miserable little club of people. So that's basically the setup. The priest is the beating heart of this film. He is so good. He is amazing. And then, of course, the horrifying male chauvinist pig of a Monseigneur is found very dead. The young priest is accused and suspected, and Benoit Blanc, for reasons entirely his own, decides to take up the case. And that's the plot of the film. I will come back to the reading list later and why The Hollow Man is in there and the rules of detective fiction, which I will try to figure out how to put in here. But what do you think of the movie? First and foremost, how did that land for you guys?
I think it was, again, I liked how unrelated it was to the previous one. But again, we're shifting the world it's set in. We're shifting the way that Benoit Blanc looks. It is these interesting ways of, you know, you've got on one level, you've got the formula, which is a very celebrity cast that are engaged in some sort of murder. But it has a very different look. It almost has a slightly different atmosphere. I really like that level of inventiveness. So it takes you somewhere else. And I'd agree, Josh O'Connor is fantastic in this. I mean, he's just sort of, it's an amazing performance. And I also like the references to the sort of like murder fiction that you basically have effectively a locked room mystery, a person who dies and it'll, you know, the characters go, well, there's lots of fiction with locked room mysteries. No one goes, my God, this is unsolvable. It's a locked room mystery. The references point, these things happen in fiction. There's a whole genre based on this. There's a whole set of rules and everything related to this. Let's talk about that when we're trying to solve this one that happened. And ultimately as well, again, the misdirection in this is so brilliantly done. And I think one of my favorite bits is you're watching and at some point Josh O'Connor says to a character, have you ever truly confessed? Are you brave enough to truly confess? And the next scene you see the person she's confessed to coming out the confessional booth with like shock and horror in his face. Audience laughs. When you watch that originally, it's a laugh. You get a laugh of it. you don't realize that you've just seen probably the most pivotal moment in the plot, because everything after that point is based on what happened in that confession booth. You just think it's a really funny punchline. There's this little old lady's confession shocked the really cynical, corrupt, evil priest. And I think that is just beautiful misdirection. That when you suddenly realize that the thing that everyone just thought was a funny punchline about an old lady confessing is actually pivotal. And, you know, it's got all these little moments. I think another favorite of mine is when he's got a photo, he's in a bar, and they've got a photo previously, and he's sort of flipping the photo from the actual what they're viewing. And everyone goes, oh my God, the bag under the chair. And it's only later you realize that, no, there's something else in that image that no one else spots, because you've been misdirected to think, oh, the bag under the chair is what's important. And it's not. And again, there's no cheating there. It's all on screen for you to look at that scene and see. And it's held for a surprisingly long time. He's just flipping. Here's one image. Here's another. It is all there. So it's not cheating. And I think that level of just misdirection, it's just fun. It just makes me sort of smile.
The humor in this is fantastic. I think just early on when Glenn Close appears for the very first time and Josh O'Connor hadn't seen her and she just shows out of nowhere and you jump. So it's both funny and introduces her character perfectly, right? The sneaky woman who knows everything about the past of this parish. I think this is perfect setting for me. Again, you know, talking of cozy crime and favorite setups, favorite atmosphere. Here, the mood is perfect, I think. A little church filmed in England, but set in the US. It's also very interesting how it's almost an irony of like filming locations and where it's supposed to be set. So it's kind of has this classic location. And then I love the characters in there. I mean, obviously, Josh O'Connor is great as this misfit priest, his backstory that we see at the very beginning, why he's sent there. And Josh Brolin as this, I don't know, he was Trumpy to me, right? He's like, if Trump was more intelligent than a priest, then maybe he could have had like this crazy following. Glenn Close, always adore seeing her in anything. And she is not just great, but she's also it's such a good character for her to play. It's one of her, you know, better later roles. And I think it just comes together here. Again, that's why I had such difficulties figuring out which of the two I prefer. But I think it is the sense of humor on the one hand, but then it's also really serious about things like religion and belief versus figuring out the truth. And I think there's this speech by Benoit Blanc that I adore this time around when he's asked about his views on, you know, religion and the truth. And he stands in the church and says, you know, I admire the architecture. And then he goes into a whole diatribe that is so essential, both about, you know, on a philosophical level, about religion versus facts. But then, of course, in Trump's America, like you said, Alan, before, you know, Ryan Johnson must have clearly sat down to write this with very clear references in mind to the second Trump era or the second Trump coming, almost a resurrection that is also pointed to in the film. It just works really, really well on these levels. It's fun, it's entertaining, it's greatly cast, and you know, the murder mystery is really interesting, but the thematic thread, again, here Josh O'Connor being the underdog character, like Janelle Monáe and Ana de Armas were, he kind of takes up that role here to a certain extent. But then they expand on this universe of typical characters for the Knives Out mysteries as well. It also does its own thing, which I really enjoyed, and which, yeah, sets it apart from both first installments.
What's interesting to me, and again, this is how it lands, and it will be different for everyone. But to me, the pivot in this film is not a pivot of plot, but it's an emotional pivot. So our young priest is in quite a lot of trouble, and Benoit Blanc is trying to get him out of quite a lot of trouble. And it gets a bit frantic, and then his phone rings, and a lady parishioner is on the phone, and she is having a very hard time, and he decides to close the door behind him, between him and Benoit Blanc, and be of service to her because she's having a hard time and he's a priest. This is a special, special scene, the way it's done, but also in the sense that this transports it from a detective plot, which is, again, in points howlingly funny, to something with a little bit more gravitas in what it means for this parish priest to be a priest. His reason for being not just in this parish, but on this earth. I thought that was brave, but I also thought that elevates the film to me. It really does, because that gives it an emotional heft that you are not, at least I was not expecting. in this really funny sort of very darkly satirical little flaky parish, to have suddenly this sort of heft to the character building and to this world that we visit in the film. I thought I'd point that out before we go back to, because oh boy, the plot, you guys.
The plot, but I must say, before we go into, you know, the crime mystery again, I must say here I enjoyed almost that level of the film more than the solution of the murder mystery. You know, there's the obviously the locked door aspect and then the breaking out, the second coming aspect, which I again enjoyed watching, but it's not why I like the film. It's almost this time around I thought, yeah, once the grave or the big tomb shows up and then the whole story around this and what really happened, I don't really care so much about this murder mystery plot. I care about the characters that are involved. I think Glenn Close and Josh O'Connor at the center of this and what the backstory is interesting, but I think I care for it because there are these characters that I have a connection to. So that's just saying before we go into the maybe the murder mystery aspect.
No, I mean, I would sort of agree with that. Again, I think again with Glass Onion, the plot, there is a feeling of like go big or go home, that like what starts out as a simple murder and then the way it sort of spirals, it becomes on quite a huge scale. And so, you know, it starts, oh, the Lockroom murder, but then you've got this notion of a man being resurrected. You've got all that just sort of builds and builds and builds. And I enjoy the films for doing that, but I don't think it's the strongest part of the film. You are stretching credulity quite a bit. You start thinking, well, what exactly is the plan here? And did they really think it would work? And again, I think a little bit with Glass Onion, when you get to the end, and I guess we're meant to sort of indulge the idea that his resurrection is now being widely believed, that there is he has a cult following, that, you know, he did come back. And I just, would people do that? Like, it just felt, you know, a lot of the secondary characters, I think one of the reasons the film is really smart to focus on Josh O'Connor, but it does mean that I think some of the suspects are quite underserved. So I think you've also got the sci-fi writer who I think exists almost just to have the punchline that he gets what he wants and he realizes that it's not what he wanted after all. He gets to write a book about this man who died and came back to life, but all the people who are into him for it is just people he can't stand. And so it has, I think it exists to make a point, but it's not too much of a story to it. Because apart from resurrection, the resurrected priest doesn't do anything. And then we're meant to sort of go, oh, it's got this lasting legacy that exists for this montage of what happened next for all these characters. And the only one that sort of I felt landed was Josh O'Connor.
Yeah, let me push back a little bit on that, because I think that we forgot to mention, just for our audience, for clarity, the whole YouTube influencer thing in this movie, that everything explodes on YouTube. Right. So the idea is not that anyone in the parish believes that the priest is resurrected. The point is that the conspiracy theorists on the internet, or some of them, might believe it, and somebody will make money or at least political capital off the idea that someone will believe it. This is pivotal in terms of the mystery plot with a failed politician who turns out to be the son. And so it gets very involved. But go on, Anna. I just wanted to clarify that.
Well, I mean, I think it's almost like the resurrection itself is feeling out, going on a tangent. I don't feel that it would have the impact that it presents in the film. In much the same way, I don't think the characters at the end of Glass Onion are going to necessarily stay good and honest till it gets to court. It's like, I can kind of think there's a list of miracles that could be ascribed to someone that would inspire a cult. But the notion that someone was resurrected and then died pretty promptly again, it just feels like the story wants to get to this ending. And there's a level of contrivance to get it there. And as with Glass Onion, okay, I'm just going to have to buy these contrivances. I don't think I fully buy them. Like, I have to make a bit of an effort to accept that this country priest, there's a bit of a question mark about his death. That then leads to what happens. It felt a bit, okay, then I'll run with it. But yeah.
There's an interesting meta aspect to this as well, because I started this off with a reading list for a reason, because the Dixon Carr novel, it's called The Hollow Man, is prominently featured in this for a reason, because Dixon Carr, as is explained in the movie, by the way, at some point in this book, The Hollow Man, he breaks the fourth wall and starts into this It's almost like a university class on how detective fiction is supposed to work. This is referenced in the movie. You can read the book, by the way. Its plot is more absurd than this one. And I sometimes think that these sort of enormously convoluted plots are a joke upon themselves. And I think that is the case in this film, because they reference this book for a reason. And the plot is really, really out there. So in that sense, I think it's a little bit referential in that not only does Benoit Blanc go into how a detective plot is supposed to work in an actual detective, like Dr. Gideon Fells or the detective does in The Hollow Man, he also has a Damascene moment in a church with a ray of sunshine lighting his face in a film about a priest. So there is a meta aspect in this that I find makes it more forgivable if the plot is really flaky. So I don't mind so much, because if a movie already references Aykroyd and unreliable narrators, and the plot by an illusionist about a man who doesn't exist, and secret passageways, and what else do we have here? A murder in an actual vicarage. It becomes more forgivable for me if it gets a little bit meta that way. And the resurrection it's a social commentary, it's a cultural commentary on the fact that on YouTube, there are some people who will believe absolutely anything. And I do believe that is basically true, generally true.
Well, I think it's a good example also, you know, the speech that you mentioned by Benoit Blanc in the church with a ray of sunshine, and how the light plays in the church anyway. It's very interestingly done throughout the film. But I think it works so well, and I think it goes to all three Knives Out movies, is that on the one hand, you have this meta level of detective fiction and the elaboration that the references to it, to even specific books in this case, and with a reading list. But then you go to Josh O'Connor's character, and right afterwards, there is this moment where Benoit Blanc understands the power of the priest without suddenly being, you know, into the power of religion, but he sees what he's able to do in the parish, and especially that specific good priest that he has beside him, despite him being misfit. But I think there's an interesting, again, a juxtaposition between, let's talk about detective fiction and the cogs and wheels of the fictional aspect on the one hand, and kind of laugh a little bit about, you know, believers in religion and conspiracy theories. And it's an interesting combination here too. But at the same time, also, once you have a good priest like Josh O'Connor, what is actually the power of the clergy or someone like that with regard to how he looks after his flock and how he relates to them emotionally? And I think that's beautifully played. It's not like beating religion and saying you guys are all stupid for believing in this crazy radical priest and following these demagogues. But once you play it well as a priest, once you really take that role seriously, you do have a different kind of power from, you know, speaking the truth.
Truth to power, yeah.
And I think it's that sort of emotional aspect which I think makes me forgive the sort of issues I have with it. That I think Josh O'Connor's performance has a reality to it that doesn't really exist in the previous two films, that is really sort of engaging. And even the point where it really worked for me, like Glenn Close's sort of final realization that the person she'd hated for so long was actually a victim. I thought that near the end, that's heavy emotional content, which you don't necessarily expect from cozy crime drawing room mystery. It's not the abstract solution of the crime. It is that a character realized this about someone else and the emotional reaction to that. So I think that part of Wake Up Dead Man makes me sort of easily able to forgive the sort of slight contrivances. I think with Glass Onion, I forgive the contrivances because it's funny and it's abstractly clever. Whereas Wake Up Dead Man, I sort of forgive them because of its emotional content. So it's a franchise that's doing sort of different things. And I guess I'm very intrigued as to where they go next, what the next one will have.
Yeah, in order to, don't let's forget, just again, to clarify the resurrection bit, the murder of Samson. So Samson is the groundskeeper and the husband of Glenn Close's character, and he's probably the most sympathetic character in the whole thing except the priest. And he dies, and I think the tragedy of his death is then what justifies the whole resurrection thing. because he was in on this rather innocent prank that went completely sour on everyone, and he has to die. And I think Glenn Close's character, that's what breaks her, I suppose, that he had to go in order for this idiotic conspiracy to even carry on. It has a very sort of Murder on the Orient Express conspiracy type sort of feel to it in terms of how far they take it. I mean, even now, I sort of have to, why did these people have to die again? I almost have to think, right? How did that... But I don't think that's the point. And I think, for instance, the murder of Samson is very, very sad and has a kind of heft that, at its best, classic detective fiction also has with this. There is one tragic instance in which sort of this death means something. I mean, there's a lot of talk about, especially with Christie and so on, that they sanitize death a lot. But I think that there is also an importance to the deaths that do occur that you, for instance, don't get in horror movies, where everybody dies by chainsaw and there's just no, it doesn't really matter. Here, the deaths are significant. So Samson's death and also, in a way, Renner's characters spiral down the literal drain. But I think it's interesting that even in Glass Onion, the death that we are, that is at the center of the film, has a heft to it. That death is tragic. That death is actually sad. And the same goes for Knives Out, the first one. The patriarch's death is in its own way sad. He was very old, but it is in its own way tragic because he was such a lively character and he really comes to life for us on screen. So in each of these films, however meta they are, they do take these deaths seriously.
I think it's interesting how you take the death seriously. I mean, with all of these, you've got like the secondary deaths. So there's always the original murder, and then you've got the death that sort of follows the murder because... as the crime unravels, people have to be killed to be kept silent or to because they get in the way of the plan or all these sort of levels of how things work, then it's an interesting twist and turn. And there has to be a level of seriousness that it's like, it's a murder. Someone's died. It's like you said, it's not a horror film. But I do think Wake Up Dead Man has an additional level of heft, like the emotional sense of loss. The characters have emotional realizations that seem very genuine and real, in a way that I don't think you get in the earlier two films. And again, I just like the variety of that. They're now going to give us, you know, a character who is emotionally real and is not just playing the abstract. Let's solve this weird locked room mystery. Oh no, I've got a phone call. I've got to answer it. I've got to deal with this. There are more important things than this funny crime game we're playing.
This puzzle, yeah.
Yeah, and I think Wake Up Dead Man engages in that. I don't think the earlier two do. Yeah, I think that's just one of the reasons I really like it. And I can forgive it.
And it's a trio of good characters, I think. You know, here you have Benoit Blanc himself and Josh O'Connor and Glenn Close's character that are all engaged in that, like, emotional journey that they make in the film that we didn't see, in, especially in Glass Onion. We saw it with Ana de Armas in the first one, right? Her and their family. But here, I think it's this trio of characters of, you could add maybe Brolin to that as well in his own radicalized way. But yeah, there's heft to all three of them and what they learn through that story. I guess that's also an interesting aspect, right? Do detectives, apart from like figuring out the crime, really learn something for their own journey as detective characters? I think that's interesting that they also play it that way, that Benoit Blanc also develops. You mentioned the look that is different here. And the introduction into the story that is different, his reactions to actual characters and scenes he witnesses. I think even though, of course, Ustinov does that, you know, understanding also some of the criminals that he engages with in his films, I think there isn't that emotional connection that he has to them. He likes them or he understands them. But here I feel, Benoit Blanc is part of the development of this as well. He's not just a cipher, the detective that comes up in any story. He's also, developing.
And I think it sort of ends with, on one level, a public failure for him. So it'll be interesting if that gets taken up. It's the sort of franchise where the next film could start off with that, or the next film would just pretend it never happened and we start with a blank slate again. And I'd be happy either way.
I wanted to, guys, just to close this off, I wanted to ask, if we compare these to the greatest age of detective fiction, which is the 20s, basically, so Sayers, Christie, Allingham, Niall Marsh, all these great queens of crime, Do these movies play by the rules as detective stories? And by that, I mean the rules are basically no jiggery-pokery, no supernatural things. The ghost did not do this. No acts of God, no deus ex machina, no Ouija boards. The characters, the murderer has to be one of the characters we've gotten to know. You don't get to pull out the serial killer in the last chapter. Do these films basically adhere to the rules of classic detective fiction? What do you think?
I sort of would go with the idea that they're not really a set of rules. There's vague guidelines, to quote something else. It has the spirit of it. And I think anyone who thinks that you have to follow the rules absolutely 100% directly, I think is going to make less interesting content. But it's like a talented musician. You kind of have to learn the basics and then you can mess with them. And I think the rule, any genre of fiction where someone sits down and goes, these are the rules of the genre, there's a good reason behind it. But I think if you're not going to play with them, if you're not going to introduce a twin, if you're not going to have fun with it, you're missing something. And I mean, just in terms of like the 20s and 30s, there's other stuff as well that, you know, you can take from crime drama then. I mean, I still have my hope that the next one, we know Benoit Blanc has a partner. We've seen Hugh Grant in the second film. Let's have the two of them, like the thin man, having a fun adventure romance as they get involved in another murder. That's what I'd like to watch. Make it a bit more, make the next one screwball, because the variety is what makes this. And then you've got a whole new set of not the traditional crime novel, the 30s screwball crime drama. Let's do one of those.
Sam, what do you think?
Well, I might not be putting too much importance on these rules. I mean, I enjoyed reading them and thinking, well, yeah, in a way, they really stick to those mostly. But I think what I enjoy is that they took the whodunit and remade it in their own image in each of those films and made kind of whodunits a central piece of filmmaking again. You know, obviously we've had the Branagh Poirot remakes and so on, but that doesn't count to me for various reasons. But to have an original new detective with classic setups, but with twists and with this kind of political dimension, you know, whodunits in Trump's America, basically, with a great cast of characters. I think it's just such an interesting mashup of, like, let's make the whodunit of the 70s or the all-star cast of the disaster movies of the 70s. Let's take this and put this into the present day and see what we can do with it. Let's have some fun. And with all this knowledge and meta level of, yeah, really believing that Rian Johnson did read these books and knows a lot and wanted to put a lot in these stories and knows about the hunger of movie fans and those references that come up and cast certain people because they've played certain roles in the past. And there's so many meta levels going on here with film history and detective fiction and the political dimension. I think that what makes them so rich and enjoyable to me. So I don't really care if they break, you know, any of these rules in the future. Maybe they should. Maybe one Knives Out should just be focused on breaking all these rules and still coming up with a great film. I don't know. But yeah, I wonder what the next setup will be. That I think that's more almost with like the White Lotus series now. Where will they go next? You know, what's the next location going to be or type of location? So that I'm most curious about, honestly.
I'm massively, whatever it is, I'm all here for it. I'm massively looking forward to it. If it's a 30s Thin Man, Harriet Vane, Lord Peter Wimsey, Oxford-based murder mystery that is actually not about the murder, but about something completely different. I'm all here for it because I love this stuff. We have to wait and see what Rian Johnson comes up with next. It will be clever, it will be classic, and it will be a lot of fun. Thank you so much to our listeners for listening to us. And I'm very glad to have started off this summer series of genre. So do tune in for the next one. And we'll hope to see you next time on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.